Anybody has any ideas as to which search will be better, progression or regression, assuming you have no heuristics? So that, nobody has any advantage. So assume they're all using the same heuristic. So would you think progression search would be faster, regression search would be faster? Better meaning what? Faster, presumably. That's the only thing we care about. Yeah? Yes, sir.
I think they're both going to be good in different situations. I can't think of any way that you'd be able to...
So give me a reason. Okay, so that's the other idea. So give me a reason why progression would be better.
I don't know. That's what I'm trying to think. I can't think of any way to know ahead of time on a problem which one's going to be better for that.
No. It's okay. I mean, just tell me if the problem was this way, whether you knew it before or not, then you can assume that progression would have been worse or better on that. So what I'm hearing is that the advantage for regression is that at least you know whatever you're doing is relevant, because you started from a top level goal and you're sub-goaling. So clearly everything you do would be relevant to the top level goal. Okay. So that is a good thing for regression. But then the bad thing for regression, that's a good thing that she's pointing out. The bad thing that the other student is pointing out is that, well, sometimes the sub-goals that you're trying to work on might actually be infeasible. That means what does it mean to say some sub-goals are infeasible? What it means, for example, here are two answers. One is they are logically inconsistent. It turns out that logically inconsistent is actually easier to check, believe it or not, compared to what we have here, okay? Logically inconsistent, so we are talking about propositional logic, right? What is the complexity of checking whether a particular formula is logically inconsistent? You guys have done algorithms, you guys have talked about, I know there are graduate students here. So complexity theory wise, what's the complexity of propositional logic? Entailment in propositional logic is co-NP complete, okay? Which means checking that a formula is inconsistent is pretty much what you actually do in doing theorem proving, right? How do you do theorem proving? You take the theorem, take the negation of the theorem, add it to what you know, and you prove that the resulting formula is inconsistent. That's how theorem proving is done, okay? And that's co-NP complete, because finding whether there is a model is NP complete. That's 2-sat and 3-sat, and this would be co-NP complete, okay? I'm saying it's worse than co-NP complete. Finding whether a set of sub-goals are inconsistent, whether they are infeasible, is harder than checking whether they are just inconsistent. Inconsistency essentially means you are asking me to find A and not A. That's inconsistent. But in the last class, we were asking you to find not clear B and holding A. That means just make those two true. It turns out that in this domain, with these two blocks and the action specifications that we have been provided, there is no way of achieving both of them. Okay? So in essence, proving that something is infeasible involves trying to find a plan for it and failing. In the worst case, a complete method for proving that something is incomplete is to try to find a plan for it and say, oh, there is no plan. That's why it's inconsistent. That's why it's infeasible. Okay? So the point he's making is, well, as long as these kinds of infeasible guys sit in the search space, that's bad. Because if they die, then, and you don't realize it, it's like necrosis, right? So they will have children who are also dead. If this was infeasible, then all their children are infeasible too. And their children are infeasible. Their children are infeasible. So all of a sudden, the search space, the search tree is full of dead nodes. Okay? And you would be wasting your time computing the heuristics on them, etc., etc. And of course, heuristics might be okay, because remember, all you will wind up having is admissible heuristics normally, which just have to underestimate the distance. If you don't have a plan, the distance is how much in terms of number of actions? Infinite. So any estimate you give is going to be admissible. And so you could be spending a lot of time extending these dead nodes and not going anywhere. Okay? And of course you can say, well, I'll just figure out which are the dead nodes, and that would be bad too, because figuring out which are the dead nodes in a complete way is too hard, because that would be as costly as planning. Which one? Exactly. So basically it's like planning. Now in fact, this also brings up this question. I said that finding whether a subset of goals is infeasible is harder than finding whether they are logically inconsistent. You know, that's a strong statement. Logical inconsistency is going to be complete. Am I saying that finding that a set of goals are infeasible, which is basically a planning problem, is harder than NP complete? Okay. It turns out it is, because the description that I have for actions, if I just use this description, this is my allowed description. You know Towers of Hanoi? Or Towers of Brahma or whatever, right? Towers of Hanoi problem can be written down as a planning problem. What does that mean? What's interesting about Tower of Hanoi problem? For a polynomial input size, the solution would be exponentially long. That's the interesting part of Tower of Hanoi, right? That's the reason why these supposedly old priests are, you know, going on and on and on, trying to take 64, you know, pegs and put them in the correct order onto the other one, okay? Because the number of moves they have to make would be 2 power 64, okay? That means the plan would be 2 power 64 actions for a 64-sized input. An input which is polynomial to 64, the output would be exponentially large. Any problem whose solution is exponentially long in the input specification cannot be NP-complete. Because, you know, those of you who know about complexity theory know that NP-complete means non-deterministic polynomial. NP means non-deterministic polynomial. What that means is, if you have God's own parallel machine, and so you can generate all solutions in parallel, and then there all of them can be checked for correctness in parallel. Okay? And if the check for correctness can be done in polynomial time, then it's an NP problem. And NP complete are the hardest of the NP problems. You can't check the correctness of an exponentially long solution in polynomial time. Right? Okay? So I'm giving you like a hand wavy proof that in fact planning in this little representation is actually harder than NP complete. It turns out it's P space complete. It is the hardest computations you can do with polynomial amount of space. Okay? So sort of a digression. I mean, there is one of the nice things about working in AI is, you know, people in psychology are interested in some of these problems, but their interest would be how do people do it. We don't care how computers are supposed to do planning. We want to know how humans do planning, which is a very reasonable thing to be interested in. Okay? But you are in CS department and AI is a CS discipline, and we are interested in, if I come up with an approach for computing plans, I want to know how hard is it. You know, and one of the nice things is, if it's not NP complete, it's probably not an AI problem. Okay, the cheapest problems you ever see in AI are NP complete, and then it gets worse. Okay, have you done first order logic? You already seen the end. I mean, it's not even the end. Turns out first order logic, resolution in first order logic is semi-decidable. That's just pretty bad. And then it turns out you throw in induction over that, then you can't even talk about completeness. That's Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Anyway, the point I was trying to make here is, A, planning is hard, harder than logical consistency check, and so in fact checking whether or not a subset of sub-goals are actually feasible or infeasible is going to take, you know, more than exponential amount of effort. That doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't try. You could actually, let's say, use a polynomial approach which is sound but not complete. That means when it says this is a dead state, it definitely is dead. When it says I don't know, it could be dead, it could be not dead. Okay? Such an approach can be used as the basis for pruning. And in fact, a large amount of search control for regression planners would be based on those kinds of ideas. You look for sound but incomplete pruning procedures. Okay? And those are possible. I mean, you can, if you're looking for those, I mean, you can make them. For example, one sound but incomplete pruning procedure is, if you have a literal and its negation in the goal list, that goal set is dead. How hard is that to check? Not particularly hard, right? And however, it won't catch that one, for example. It will let this go further. One of the interesting questions that you might ask is, what exactly happens to this state if I only have this kind of a check? That means I only prune the set where a literal and its negation occurs. If you do that, then you can be sure that every one of these kinds of inconsistencies, when you extend them, will become that kind of inconsistency. Except by that time, this one node has become exponential number of nodes. Every level you go, the number of children are increasing exponentially. Okay? So basically what you wind up doing is you go that much farther down, and then eventually they will all be seen as this kind of inconsistency. How does that happen? Because these actions that you wrote will have preconditions, and some preconditions will wind up being inconsistent with what you're trying to do. So it will happen in two different ways. One is either you will find this kind of things in the state itself, or better yet, you would find a state which cannot be expanded at all because no action satisfies this condition. That means you better not kill anybody that is required in the state. So every action is going to kill one of them, so none of them can be used. So a state doesn't have children, it's a dead state. Search would not care about it. So that's exactly what happens in this particular case. Okay, so that's a long description of why regression can be bad. Why can progression be bad? I mean, she said that in doing progression, you don't know whether or not it's relevant. How many of you do progression-based planning in your daily life? What? You do? So you wake up in the morning and say, let's see what all I can do. And so that means you are not planning to be here. Right? When you wake up in the morning, all progression is doing, by the way, is if you don't have a heuristic, you can remember we said we don't have any heuristics. If you don't have a heuristic, progression does an action because it can be done. Okay? When I wake up in the morning, so I can turn this side, I can turn that side, I can stand up, I can sit down, I can stare at the TV, I can do all sorts of things, you know, a huge branching factor.
So I thought I can go to AI, I can have breakfast, I can just go somewhere else.
But no, you just reduced the branching factor. Most of the people, by the time they even started talking about the first billion opportunities, they didn't even say, I can go to AI, which is not an action, by the way. It's a higher level action. It's a higher level goal, right? The branching factor is very huge. So when in any reasonable world, the number of actions you can do is much higher than the number of actions that can be done. So, you know, some of you know this because some of you have been in classes I've taught, but I like this joke, so I'll tell you again about the Sherlock Holmes joke, right? I mean, there was a BBC competition for the funniest joke in the world, and then, you know, people voted. This was, I think, 5-6 years back. There were no spam voting yet because not enough people had computer accounts. And there was a particular joke that became the funniest joke in the entire world. And then there was a separate joke that was funnier in US, you know, that will involve guns because, you know, if there's no gun, you know, we don't like it. The overall world, the funniest joke is the following. Sherlock Holmes and Watson go out on camping, right? And then they do whatever they do in the whole day, and then in the evening they pitch a tent, you know, they had their food, and they go to sleep. And the middle of the night, Holmes wakes up, Watson, and says, "Watson, look up, tell me what you see, and tell me what you can deduce." Remember, you know, Sherlock Holmes always is into deduction. So Watson looks up and says, "I see stars. I see many, many stars. From that I can deduce that we are not alone in the world, which means there may be a supreme being, which means that the stars are probably being held by various forces, which means that at some point of time we may be able to reach stars," and he's going on and on and on. All of these are great deductions he can make. And then Sherlock Holmes looks at Watson and says, "Watson, you dummy, this means that our tent was swiped." Okay? The most reasonable, most important, conclusion you have to make in that particular case is, how the heck are you seeing the stars? You're supposed to be sleeping in the tent, right? But just because you can make a deduction doesn't mean it's worth making it. And you saw this in forward chaining reasoning versus backward chaining reasoning. Prologue is backward chaining, okay? And you can do resolution forward or backward way. Okay, and the trade-offs in resolution in the forward and backward are similar to the trade-offs in progression versus regression. Okay, going forward, everything looks like it's worth doing. I'm doing it because it can be done, not because it will be useful. Okay, now of course, once you have heuristics, things change. Because once you have heuristics, a heuristic is supposed to tell you which one is going to take you towards the goal. That changes the comparison. That's why I was asking you to think about it before the heuristics. Okay. So that's the two reasons why, I can say that progression is good, I can say regression is good. You know, in some cases, if the branching factor is too high, you know, progression planners just die before they even start. But on the other hand, if I carefully make a benchmark domain, and I wrote the domain description using those kinds of actions, I won't write irrelevant actions because it's too painful for me. So human-made benchmarks don't have too many irrelevant actions. But life, on the other hand, does, because life is a combination of many, many loosely coupled domains. And so there are huge number of things that you can do that are not relevant. Okay. What about this next one? How can you do regression in worlds where the actions are not reversible? I'm saying I can do regression, but I may be in a world where the actions cannot be reversed. Do you understand the difference? I mean, an action is reversible in the sense, like, you know, bombing is forever. You know, after bombing, you can't unbomb things. Okay, so is capital punishment. It's forever. You can't bring them back. You know, whereas you put them in jail for 1 year, you know, the whole lifetime, after 3 years you can say, "Oh, we screwed up. We can come out and we'll pay you $2 million, you know, for the mistake we made." But you're dead, you know, tough luck. Okay? So that's an irreversible action. So the question is, see, if I have worlds where there can be reversible actions, in the blocks world, are there any reversible actions? What? What are the irreversible actions in the blocks world? All I had is stack, whose reverse is unstack, and pick up, whose reverse is put down. So blocks world is an easy world. Everything is reversible. So I can imagine doing regression, I guess, according to this question, in blocks world. But what if I'm doing regression in a domain where there are irreversible actions, such as bombing? Can I do regression there? Why? How many people think this actually makes sense? I mean, the rest of you are sleeping anyway, that's fine, but the people who are still awake, do you think this is a reasonable question to worry about, or it's too obvious that it doesn't make any sense to even ask this question? If you are one of the latter, you should tell me why it is so obvious. You had a reason, for example. What is the reason why?
When you're regressing, you're not doing it backwards, you're still doing it forward. You're just using the effect of the condition.
No. When you're regressing, you're doing search.
Right.
You're thinking.
Right.
It doesn't matter. When you think, you can think backward, forward, everywhere.
Right.
Okay? If on the other hand, you are working from the goal state towards the initial state, or from the goal initial state towards the goal state, in the real world, reversibility matters. Okay, this is just a sanity test. You have to understand search. You can do any crazy thing in search. Search order has nothing to do with execution order. You can make the eventual plan in the backward way, forward way, middle to upward way. Okay. In fact, there is a very beautiful quote. I think Spinoza or somebody who said, "Life only makes sense in backwards analysis, but it has to be lived in the forward direction." And that's the unfortunate thing. You have no clue whether or not you're having a good life or not. You know. So after you are dead, you know, hopefully we'll write an obituary where we'll say whether you had a good life. But you can only live it in the forward direction. So the execution has to be done in the forward direction. But that doesn't mean that you can't plan for a good life, because you know how obituaries would be written, you know. For example, if you're a mass murderer, they won't write good ones. So try not to do those things. Okay? So the point I'm making here is regression, progression, they're all in search. And in fact, there's one more way of doing planning, which I don't discuss, but the textbook talks about, which is plan space planning, where you essentially, you know, if I sort of do a hand-wavy description of plan space planning, it will look like this. So here is my set of things that are true in the initial state. Let's say I1, I2, etc., IN. Here are the few things I want to make true, G1, etc., GK. This is the end state. Okay? So then I'll do like this. Well, okay, I need somebody to give G1. Okay, here. AK, you give G1. Since you're giving G1, you better come before G1. So I'll put an ordering from you to there. Okay, actually let me use two different colors and say if you're giving, I will put a causal link. This is a causal link, and I put that in green. Okay? And since giving cannot happen in the backward direction, I have to have an ordering. Let's see. Okay. And that ordering is AK has to come before where it is needed. Okay? Then I'll say, well, somebody needs to give, so this is A1, let's say. And somebody needs to give G3. Okay? I'll put A3, who will give G3. So the red ones are orderings, and the black ones are essentially a way you keep track of bookkeeping as to why you put an action into the plan, because they were trying to satisfy something. Now, but then the problem is, you know, I put A1 here. A1 requires certain things to be true before it, because it has preconditions. So it sets up its own little mini goal state in front of it. Okay? And so it might say, I would need P and Q. So then I recurse. I'll say, I'll put an action here which will give me P. Okay? And the orderings I put are only the least amount of orderings I need to causation, to provide the causation. The only other kinds of orderings might be, suppose A3 is giving G3, A1 is giving G1, A1 requires P, A3 deletes P. In the sense, it has an effect which negates P. That's possible, right? An action can undo something, and another action requires it. Now, if I leave these actions like this, it looks as if A1 can be done in any order with respect to A3. It can be done before, after, or in parallel. But we know that because P can be killed by this guy, it better not come between the guy who is giving P, this is AP who is giving P to this guy, and the guy who needs P. So this action has to be out of this interval.
Are you searching in parallel?
I'm not searching in parallel. I'm just making the plan in a partially ordered way. And I would argue that if you, you know, they say introspection is the lousiest form of psychology, but if you try to introspect, you might realize that you actually do planning this way. So you have a whole bunch of things to do. You'll say, oh, I have to do this, I have to do this. Oh, by the way, I can't be both there and there, so maybe I should do this before. This is how you're changing the plan as the plan is being made. So In the plan space planning, a plan is a partially ordered set of actions, and any topological sort would be a correct plan. Okay? Now this, notice that when you execute it, you have to execute it one with respect to one of the topological sorts, otherwise it don't make sense. Okay? But because you are searching, it doesn't matter how you construct the plan. When you are about to execute, it should be done, you know, with a front to the back. Okay? So that's the basic idea behind plan space planning. You keep track of who is giving what to who, and if two guys are interacting in the sense that one guy kills the precondition required by another guy, then you make sure that they get reordered such that they won't get into each other's way. If you can't, that plan dies. That's how search works in partial order planning. Okay? What? Yes, but I would argue that in fact you do the planning this way. And there is a reason, you have to ask yourself, why do we do planning this way?
Again,
please understand the following. In fact, it turns out, since you said this, in fact it turns out that the current state of the art planners, very few of them use partial order planning. Okay? So in that sense you're right. Okay? But if I did the same kind of reasoning after balanced trees and height balanced trees, I would be wrong. Because just because height balanced trees are harder to program doesn't mean we shouldn't use them. Eventually the question is whether the program will be faster. Whether, you know, and the reason, in fact, writing the program for partial order planning is in fact more complicated than writing the program for progression. And then less and then regression is a little more complicated than the progression. But that has nothing to do with what you're supposed to be doing. You know, you're CS people. You shouldn't care about how hard the program is to write.
Yeah.
It's how fast it works and how good it is in terms of the solution quality. Okay? Fine. So I will stop with this part. And before I move on, I have an infomercial, which is that there's going to be a course that I'm going to be teaching next semester, 494, which is information retrieval, which has two possibly recommended background four-level courses. One is this, 471. And information retrieval, mining, and integration, you know, that's the web page for that. You can actually, you know, click on that and you can see what's going on there. But less, more importantly, it's sort of about search engines and web and so on, and you might think it really has not too much to do with AI, okay? And it turns out a lot of that course, really, a lot of how Google-like search engines will work and how it's supposed to work, how the web is supposed to be organized, is going to be connected to AI. And in fact, I put this, there are bunches of, if you actually do Google and AI, it turns out, I don't know how many of you have thought about it, the area
are the world's favorite search engine, but Google has spelled out a vision for
intelligent
search engine so powerful they will understand everything in the world. It's the dream of Larry Page, one of Google's founders and now a multi-billionaire. He was in London this week for a conference attended by the creme de la creme of Europe's so-called technorati, our business correspondent Tyson Islam, went to find out if Google can really stay.
Sorry, this is not working actually.
It is from humble beginnings as a hobby horse index.
Oh, okay.
Website comment, Page and fellow Stanford graduate Sergey Brin have plans to turn the simple but lucrative Google web search into something far more powerful.
The ultimate search
engine. That's how Page looks anyway.
You know, with understand exactly what you want when you type your query, or maybe something more complicated. And it'll take you back, you know, the exact right thing instantly. And in computer science, we call it artificial intelligence, because you could ask me anything, say, what should I ask where today? And it will be able to tell you.
So, if you thought, you know, all these crazy things are based on databases and stuff, and nothing else, you actually are taking a course which is quite relevant to that course, and all that you need to do is suffer through me, and you could, you know, take that course. So, in case you're interested, look up that web page. Okay. Okay. So this basically was the summary of what we just discussed you know, progression, regression. Progression has a higher branching factor. Progression searches in the space of complete states. Regression has a lower branching factor, but regression searches in the space of partial states. Now, how do you say searches in the state of part, in the space of partial states, and make it look like you are actually complaining? Okay, and for that you have to understand, if you have n literals, the number of complete states are 2 power n, right? Whereas the number of partial states is 3 power n, because in any state a literal may be present positively, present negatively, not present at all. That means a goal state basically might require this literal to be present positively, present negatively, or I don't care about this literal at all. Those are three options. So 3 times 3 times 3 times 3 n times 3 power n. So the funny thing, and in fact this is an interesting point, it looks as if the search, the goal-directed regression search, should be searching in a much smaller space, right? In terms of branching factor, it is, because the branching is smaller. But in terms of the search space size, you could actually argue it searches in a much bigger space, because it's partial state, and that's 3 power n rather than 2 power n. Okay? Anyway, so there are reasons to say either one is good, and this is the never-ending war between both of them. Right now, at the end of this, it looks as if, well, either of them can be better. Okay? And we will revisit this at the end of today's class with respect to some of powerful heuristics that are currently being used in planning, and say, what's the state of the art? You know, which particular kind of planners are winning the competition, for example. Okay? Okay, so if you want to do, so I am interested in doing either of these searches, and I want heuristics for them. And one of the things I promised at the last class was, if you have structure to your states, then you should be able to automatically derive heuristics. Okay, so the idea is, within this action, precondition effect based representation, you can write any random problem, a large class of random problems. For example, Tower of Hanoi can be written this way, Luxworld can be written this way, some other kinds of planning problems. Any planning problem you can think of can potentially be written in this language. Now, if I can tell you a way of generating heuristics which is based not on whether it's Luxworld or Tower of Hanoi, but it's only based on the action representation, the preconditions and effects of the actions, then I've done something useful, because I've told you an automatic way of generating heuristics for an entire class of planning problems, the entire class of problems. Okay. So the question, of course, is for planning, for let's say this kind of search, what would be a heuristic? I'll give you one idea. Okay. So basically, a heuristic is supposed to tell me, okay, here, let's assume, if I don't tell you otherwise, that I'm trying to optimize for the number of actions. The fewer the actions, the better the plan. So you want to find an optimal plan which has the least number of actions. Okay? And then, so the heuristic is supposed to tell me cost to go. How many actions do I need to take to go from here to the goal state? Or if I'm going this way, how many actions do I need to take to go from here to the initial state? That's what the heuristic is supposed to tell me. Okay? In fact, the idea is, in this case, I'm trying to get reachability information. How far am I from the goal state? In this case too, I'm kind of getting a reachability information, which is how far am I from the initial state. Okay. Now, one simple heuristic that I'll give you, and it in fact has been used lots and lots of time for a long time, is the following. Suppose I have a goal state, which is basically a state is just a set of literals, right? Okay. And I have a goal state. Remember, this is my goal state. I would say a reasonable heuristic is count the number of goals that are not already true in the state. So the set difference between the goal state and the current state. Not symmetric, just the set difference. G minus S cardinality, minus the set minus. Okay? Reasonable heuristic. Looks just as simple as the kind of other heuristics you have seen, which is straight line distance or counting the number of misplaced tiles or something like that. Okay? So the question is, first of all, is that admissible? What?
If you do not have a heuristic, then what is the value?
No. The heuristic, if you basically, for each state that you have generated, I know how many actions I did to get to that state. I also need to know how many actions I expect to take so that I can plot G plus H equal to F.
Okay.
A star search, that's what we'll do. We will do A star search.
There's no heuristic
H equal to zero. If there's no heuristic, H equal to zero. That's the idea. Okay? So the question is, if I do this set difference heuristic, this is called set difference heuristic, is it, first of all, admissible? What if an action winds up making more than one goal true at the same time? So suppose you have a initial a goal state which has five goals, current state has, you know, one of them true, so the difference is four, and another state here has three of them true, so that means its cost is only two. It looks like this is better than this, except there is an action which makes all four of them true at the same time. So it's not admissible. Okay, again, one of the nice things about dealing with planning, and of course any chapter, is that, you know, you can also look back at what you have learned and see whether those concepts make sense. I mean, you talked about admissibility. Today I will talk a lot about whether a particular heuristic is admissible or not. Okay, it's not necessary that you care about only using admissible heuristics. I tend to think that the difference between computer scientists and hackers is computer scientists first try to prove optimality, first try to prove correctness, and then say to heck with it. It's too costly to actually ensure them and do whatever program they want to do. And a programmer doesn't care, just starts from scratch and writes a program. Okay? It's not necessarily that computer scientists only want to generate optimal solutions, because sometimes you may not be able to generate optimal solutions given the time limitation. The difference is, do you know when you did not generate an optimal solution? If you're using a set difference heuristic, you should know upfront that there are no guarantees. So I shouldn't be surprised. If I get an inoptimal solution, it's not because my program has a bug, it's because it was expected sometimes to provide inoptimal solutions because the heuristic is inadmissible. Okay? That's set difference heuristic. Now, that doesn't work too well, it turns out. Okay? So I'll give you a different heuristic, which is at a completely different level, which is, you might say I'm being stupid, but here is what I'll do. I'll say this is my current state, and you want to know how far the goal state is. I'll just do the progression search starting from this current state until one of these states becomes the goal state. Right? And then I will take the number of actions on the path from the initial to the goal state. That would be a heuristic. Is that an admissible heuristic? Yes, it is. Is it a perfect heuristic?
Yes,
it is. Does it make any sense to use that heuristic? Of course not, because you are solving a planning problem once for each state. Okay? So, I have this picture right here. I don't know whether, you know, Juan Lu already showed you, but this is a favorite picture of mine. Everything important in the world seems to have this kind of a shape, which is the amount of time you spent computing the heuristic. Okay, actually I won't draw the entire picture, okay. I showed you two heuristics. One heuristic was very easy to compute. Extremely easy to compute, you know, set difference heuristic. But I already told you the amount of search you do with that heuristic is quite high. Okay? And on the other hand, if you use this other heuristic I told you, which is do the entire problem and use it as a heuristic to solve the problem again, right? You'd spend a huge amount of time doing the heuristic computation and no time at all doing search. Right? Okay? So, if in fact there would be some way of connecting these curves. So I'll make a curve here. So here is the time spent computing the heuristic for different, you know, heuristics. Okay? So here are the heuristics H1, H2, H perfect. Okay? I mean, it's not a obviously reasonable scale. I just made names for them. And then for each of these, here is the search time. The question is, what's the best heuristic? intersection point. Why? Because essentially what you care about is the sum. What you care about is the sum. And the sum would be minimized there. It turns out all of search is figuring out this magic point for each search problem. Okay? You can always find extremely cheap heuristics which are completely useless, extremely hard heuristics which make you do the problem many more times than what you want to do, and then say then the rest of the problem is very easy. Okay? What is the hardest heuristic you have done in the A-star search description? You guys, I mean, I don't know what you did in the class. So what's the hardest heuristic you used in any domain in the A-star search that you discussed? What? Minimum spanning tree. How hard is minimum spanning tree to compute? Not particularly hard. Compared to that, I mean, it's much better than, you know, number of misplaced tiles. Number of misplaced tiles is a little easier than Manhattan distance, you know, sum of Manhattan distances. Minimum spanning tree looks a little more interesting. So the question is, there is a tendency in search literature for the longest time to assume that heuristics can't take too much time, which seems like a reasonable thing to do. If you're trying to solve a problem, right, and you're doing heuristics so that you will solve the problem faster, and if the heuristic itself is taking a large amount of time, it can't potentially be a good idea, right? And one of the interesting things in science is it's your biases that are much worse than your failures. Okay, if you have a bias, then you would not try certain ideas. You know, for the longest time, we did not even want to try heliocentric theory. We put people behind bars if they even tried to say Earth is not in the middle. Okay, what's wrong? Why don't you let them try it? And if it can be proved to be a bad theory, we can then put them in jail. You know, like bad graduate students should be put in jail, for example. That's not what we do. We actually disallow some hypothesis because of the biases. Okay, and so the bias that was there in the search literature has always been heuristics should be easy to compute. That's why you oftentimes, when you think of heuristics, it looks like a very simple, you know, simple computation. Okay, but you may be right, you may be wrong. It depends on where this intersection point is. If this intersection point is more towards this direction, you would be right. If it's more towards this direction, you would be wrong. Okay, so let me explain to you with respect to that background. Nobody really assumes that it would be here, right? It cannot possibly be here because you have solved the problem more than once here. Now how can solving the problem 18 times be cheaper than solving it just once without any heuristic? The question is, how much closer can you, for example, have high order polynomial heuristics? Okay, and could you, for example, spend an entire class describing a heuristic? Did you ever describe a heuristic in an entire class in this semester yet? You get to do it today, right? I'm going to describe a heuristic which actually takes two classes to describe, but I'll talk, you know, twice as fast so that we'll be done. In fact, you know, four times as fast so that we'll be done. And the interesting point that I want you to take from that is, A, that heuristic is being described because that actually does the best in planning. And it's counterintuitive. And any time your stereotype is broken is when you wake up, right? That's the bias. And the reason it's counterintuitive is we tend to think this is more towards this side. We don't know it, okay? So let me tell you some heuristic, which is, you know, this is bad, okay? But I have a different idea, a slightly different idea, which is, as that is being constructed, I'm constructing a different structure below here. Okay, I'll call this planning graph, and you know, it's a name. So I put P, and I put a P here. I have P, Q, P, R, P, S are the states. That means P dash, I mean P and R, Q are the literals true in that state, P and R are the literals true in this state, P and S are the literals true in this state. Here I just union those three states, just union them, as if the membranes have disappeared. So there's the state membranes, they just disappear. So merge the states, it becomes a union. Okay, so I have PQRS here. Okay, then I go forward, I have PQR, PQ, PQS, blah, 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 union this. First of all, do you understand that structure? It's connected to the progression tree, projection tree. Now, clearly, I could not be saying first construct this and copy down what is there here, because if that, if I do that, then if this was a bad idea, this is a bad idea plus an extra epsilon bad idea, because you wasted even more time. The interesting thing is, while I understand this based on that, in fact this can be constructed directly. You don't need to look at that. All I'm doing is the following. I start with the initial state, okay? I'll put every action whose preconditions are present in the previous state. These are not really states. We call them proposition lists. In the planning graph terminology, we call them proposition lists. Okay? So we put anybody whose preconditions are true in the previous state, they can be put in. You don't care whether they get along or not. Just put all of them in parallel. And if they give an effect, put that effect in the next level. Okay? And then remember, in normal strips, not only do you put the effects, you copy over everything that's not changed, right? So to do that, we assume that for every literal, there is a dummy action whose only aim in life is to persist that literal. Okay, these are a bunch of dummy actions. They don't change the problem. All you do is, if there's P, I just persist to that direction. Okay, everything is persisted, even if it's also being given by an action. So for example, by the time you come here, A1 is giving Q, but Q can also be persisting.
How do you handle contradiction?
What?
How do you handle
wait. So clearly, this looks not like something that's completely useful to do planning. Okay, but remember what we talked about in the pruning case. You know, we had this problem that we can't show that something is infeasible and be complete as well as sound. So we said, let's be sound if not complete. So when I say it's infeasible, it's infeasible. When I don't say it's infeasible, it may still be infeasible. Let's try that here too. Okay, so in this structure, clearly, the problem with this is, I have PQRST. One would say a reasonable semantics for this proposition list is every subset, the states correspond to subsets of this proposition list. Okay, so the states in the real tree are being generated from the blocks here. These are the Lego blocks with respect to which these states are made. Okay, but not all of them are being put into each of the states. Okay, so while it is true that everything that occurs in any of the states here will be occurring here, the converse is not true. Not every subset here is a state here. If it was if and only if, then constructing this should be just as hard as constructing the other one, and you would be sunk. Right?
So how is this?
This is actually polynomial time. because the length of this, so one of the interesting things is, notice that here there's huge number of states. I just have one proposition list. I'll go here, it'll be even more exponentially larger number of states. Just one proposition list. The only question you have is, will I ever stop doing this? Okay? Can somebody tell me whether I can stop doing this expansion at some point of time? If two levels, two consecutive levels don't change, then they'll never again change. Do you understand what I'm saying? If two consecutive levels don't change, that means no new literals have come into the proposition list between level I and level I plus 1. Then you say, I'm leveled off. I have leveled off. I don't need to do any more work. And I am guaranteed that I will reach level off, because the upper bound for level off is the number of literals, which is just twice the number of state variables in the Boolean case. And oftentimes you reach level off much before that, because there are no actions which change things. Okay? So it turns out computing this structure, as ugly as it looks, you know, in fact, one of these nice things is, if I were really giving you a test, I would ask you to do a couple of planning graphs in midterm, for example, and they can get reasonably ugly. You'll see in a minute that for the blocks world, I'll show you how the planning graph looks. It's easy to write a program. It's one of these cases where it's much easier to write a program to generate a planning graph than to show the instructor you know how to construct the planning graph. Because you need a really large piece of paper to write these things without getting into total confusion. And there are some things computers are much better at it than us, right? Okay, so now, well, if I have this structure, why is this interesting? A, it's easier to compute, but so many things are easier to compute. Why is this helping me? ask yourself the following question. I want to know whether or not a set of goals, P, can P be achieved, let's say M, can M be achieved by level 1? If it could have been achieved, it should have been present here. This is a superset of things that are achievable by one level. So anything you are trying to prove to be achievable by level 1, if it's not present, then it definitely cannot be achieved by one level. If it is present, it may still not be achievable by one level. That's the question for your interactions issue. Just because it's present in a level doesn't mean that there is a plan of that length. But if it's not present in that level, that means there is no plan of that length. You see that? Okay? So here is my great idea. You know, when you have a state, you know, here is the idea. So you're doing a proposition, a projection, right? So you're doing projection. For each of these states, I construct a planning graph from them. Okay? And then look at the first proposition list where the goals are present. Take the index of that level. That is my heuristic value. That's the number of actions I need. Okay? And I would say that, so the question of course is, this is called a level heuristic, and the question is this admissible?
You're picking the least amount with an underestimate.
So it will be admissible. Okay? It would be admissible. And it turns out, now obviously this requires a bit of a discussion to actually explain how the planning graph is constructed. I had to explain to you the notion of persistence actions. I had to explain to you that all actions are being put in. In fact, there are extensions of planning graph which try to take into account interactions between them. In the textbook, they discuss these so-called mutual exclusions. I won't discuss it in the class. Okay? But partly because, in fact, those extensions haven't really led to very fast heuristics. Okay? But completely ignoring interactions between actions, assuming everything can be done, you still may say that certain goals require at least 4 steps, certain other goals require 3 steps, certain other goals require, they don't ever come into the planning graph. For example, if I extended this planning graph until it levels off, and the goal that I want is not present even in the level of level, what would be its cost? What would be its heuristic cost? Infinity. Because this is the upper bound of what you can make true. And if your upper bound doesn't have what you want to achieve, then it's not possible. And you can give h equal to infinity and still be sure that it's admissible heuristic. Because the true cost will also be infinity. Okay? So it's a nice idea. You know, it looks like, you know, painful thing to do, but it's a nice idea. And if you connect it to, let's say, set difference heuristic at this level, I mean, this is my pre-made picture of that, set difference heuristic here and H star here, if you write three planners with these three different heuristics, this heuristic that I just told you beats the heck out of this one and this one. And you're not surprised that you can beat the heck out of this one, right? Because that's a bad heuristic anyway. In a sense, too much work. This will beat the heck out of it. And most other simpler ideas that have been tried in planning for generating heuristics did not work either. Okay? So, the question, of course, is previously when we talked about heuristics, and then, you know, here is another example for cake, which is in your textbook. You know, I did it in terms of abstract literals P, Q, and R. Okay, the textbook talks about a specific little planning domain which essentially has 2 actions, eat the cake and bake the cake. Okay, and so if you look at their planning graph, again, these are the persistence actions. Have cake will still be there. If you have cake, you can eat cake, in which case you won't have cake and you would have eaten the cake. Okay. And if you have not eaten the cake, you will still have not eaten the cake by this particular action. You might be saying, how can you have the cake and eat it too, which is present here, but I never said every subset is a legal state. That's what you are giving up. It's just that what I want isn't even present here, then I'm dead. But if it's present here, it's only a lower bound estimate, which is exactly what heuristics are supposed to give you. Okay? Now the question is, what am I relaxing? Remember the last time, well, I hope, when you talked about heuristics, you talked about relaxation as the way heuristics are generated. What did we relax here? It looks like, if anything, I was all wound up. I'm making all these crazy, you know, things, right? What am I relaxing here? And by the way, it turns out that although this is the picture that the textbook has, and, you know, ignore these things, these are the mutex relations that can be added on top of it. And you can read this after my discussion, but I won't talk about it, you know. The mutexes take into account some of the what you call negative interactions, okay, the bad things. When we say interactions, we mean negative interactions. Okay, positive interactions means two things together help each other, because of which the plan becomes shorter than before. Okay, but anyway, it turns out even this, I can draw a true full projection tree and show that in fact these proposition lists are actually just the merge of the full projection tree. And this is a small enough problem that you can draw it yourself and, you know, see that what I showed in that abstract problem is exactly what is happening here. Except I don't need this. I can just generate this directly, because I just throw in every action whose preconditions are true in the previous step, a previous proposition list. All I'm doing is a bunch of bookkeeping. If I'm giving this, I put a link from here to here. And for example, this guy is being given by two people, so I'll have links from two people. Okay, that means in some sense more people can give this. Both by persistence or by doing something, I can get it. Okay? Now, so that's another thing. Now if you want to do this for blocks world, okay, this is how it would look. So it would start with auntie A, auntie B, clear A, clear B, hand empty. And then this is the first level. That's the second level. Okay, and I missed some of them. You know, I should tell you. This is the second level. And clearly this is not the kind of thing you would enjoy doing in the midterm, especially when there are 3 minutes left in the exam. Okay? But your computer would really love doing this, because it's extremely easy to do. It would really thank you that you're only asking it to do this, as again as doing the full projection, because this is only polynomial, that's exponential. And using this heuristic, your program can do much better than anybody using set difference heuristic. And this is, as I said, an admissible heuristic. Okay, now, actually, in fact, this is one of the things to point out, that if you read the end of the chapter, we actually talked about this idea many years back in 2001, I think, in A471, in ASU. And I gave a project for people to do this. And somebody who did the project actually found this heuristic works. And it's now part of a textbook. Okay? And it was an ASU student. So you can do that too. Okay. The other question that I want to ask is, we clearly know how to deal with single literal based things. What if I have a set of literals? My goal state always has a set of literals. How does this heuristic work for a set of literals? Okay? It turns out that if I have a set of literals, I have a couple of options. I'll talk about two options. Okay? So, to understand the distinction, so you can actually say, so if I want to look for P, Q, and R is my set, P, Q, and R are my goals. So I look at the planning graph, look for the first level where P becomes true. Let's say that is second level, so that's number, that's two. This becomes true in third level, so this is three. This becomes true in seventh level, this is seven. Seven plus three plus two is 12 is going to be the heuristic value for the set PQR. That's one idea. If I do this, what did I decide? What did I actually say? So if I have, think about the following question. If I have three goals, P, Q, and R, the shortest plan for achieving P has length LP. Okay? In fact, I don't even need to three goals, just two goals is enough. Shortest plan for achieving Q is length LQ. And the shortest plan for achieving PQ together is LPQ. Tell me how LPQ is connected to LP and LQ. I can say LPQ is nothing but LP plus LQ. I can say LPQ is much greater than LP plus LQ, or I can say LPQ is less than LP plus LQ. Those are the possible things just from mathematically, right, between these quantities. The question is, are all three possible? If you can understand this, you have a knack for thinking of goals in life. Okay? You always have multiple things you are trying to do. You know, you're trying to make your boyfriend or girlfriend happy, you're going to try and make an instructor happy, you're trying to make your boss happy. Some of these help each other, some of them hurt each other, some of them are completely independent. Okay? If the goals P and Q are completely independent, that means the plan for P has nothing to do with the plan for Q, then the plan for achieving both would just be concatenation of those two plans. So this would be true if they are independent. Okay? If the two goals cannot be done together at all, so, you know, it's like one of these Visa commercials, you know, it's like, you know, the price of this is $10, the price of this is $20, the price of this is $40, the entire thing priceless, right? So the idea is, if in fact L of P is having A on B, on AB is goal P, and goal Q is on BA, I can achieve on AB in $10, or maybe one or two steps. I can achieve on BA in one or two steps. I cannot achieve on AB and on BA, even if you give me infinite number of steps. Right? In that case, clearly the goals are not independent. They are interacting. How are they interacting? Are they helping each other or hurting each other? Hurting each other. So they are called negative interactions, negatively interacting. Okay? Negatively interacting. The other possibility is it can be positively interacting. Okay, there is this story, I think, about Newton. It's been told about various other people. All of these are apocryphal. That Newton once called a carpenter and said, make two holes in my door. And he said, why do you need two holes? He said, I have a big dog and a small dog, and both of them need to come into the home. Right? And, you know, of course, you get to laugh at Newton. It's very few times we get to laugh at Newton. So this is one of the times. And what he missed there was the positive interactions between the goals. It turns out that if the big dog can go, so can the small dog. And you really need only one hole. Okay? And similarly, I can actually have a scenario where, for example, let's say I have B and, let's say B and A, and I have the hand. All I want are two goals, on BA and clear B. You can't make on BA true without making clear B true on the way. So if you take the cost of each of them independently and add them up, you would be overestimating the cost. Okay? So, planning graph is missing what kind of interaction? When you do planning graph style analysis, what kind of interactions are you missing? It's clearly missing negative interactions. That was what one of the questions from this is. You know, sometimes the plan may not be possible. It's clearly missing negative interactions because it's not, you know, it's assuming things don't destructively get onto each other. Okay. If you miss negative interactions, remember the names, you do know, admissibility and informedness. Right? Okay. And the best way to think about admissibility and informedness, it turns out, is if I have my HP is this, my H star is this. Okay, these are the nodes. This is my H star. Any curve which is always below this is admissible. Any curve which is closer to this but still remains below this is admissible and informed. If I have a heuristic which is kind of extremely close to this, but once it crosses, unfortunately, if you cross it even once, you lose admissibility. It's a badge, and you cross your H star once, you're dead. And oftentimes, in designing heuristics, admissibility and informedness work against each other. To make things informed, you need to get them closer and closer to the true value, H star. In doing so, sometimes you'll cross H star. So you lose the badge of admissibility. If you want to be safe, take H equal to 0. That's been proven to be admissible. Right? If nothing else, you know that. Okay? I am using no heuristic, so I'm admissible. Okay? So the interesting question, of course, is if my domain has all completely independent goals. Completely independent goals. Okay, first of all, let me ask you this question. If your life, I'm God, and you know, or whatever, atheist God, and I'm going to make your life up for you, and I can tell you, you know, if you want, you can tell me, let's make all my goals in my life be either independent or negatively interacting or positively interacting. Which would you rather ask? What's going to be your, what would you ask the God to make your, you know, goals to be? Independent. Remember the Seinfeld episode where worlds collide between, the home George and the friendship George? You know, he kept them independent and he was happy. And when they start colliding, bad things can happen. Okay? If you want to have multiple relationships, for example, you know, far be it for me to suggest that to you, you would like the world to be independent. Okay? So independent is really what you want. Harder is negative, clearly. Is positive really worse than independent? If your goals are positively interacting, and you just say, oh, what the heck, I'll assume they're independent. Would the heuristic based on such an analysis be admissible? No. If you ignore positive interactions, you lose admissibility. If you ignore negative interactions, you only lose informedness, which we never cared much about. Because, you know, we write bad programs, they take long time anyway. Okay? So that's the reason actually why, even though I was telling you about a planning graph which completely ignores negative interactions, I can still say that's admissible, and it will give you a plan which, when it gives the plan, that will be optimal. If you ignore positive interactions when they are there, then you lose the badge of admissibility. If you like to have admissibility badge, that's a bad thing. Okay? In the case of planning graph, positive interactions, if you take level heuristics, so now keep that in back of your mind, and for the set PQR, I can assume this is, I'll just say the heuristic is P plus Q plus R. Or I can say it is the max of those three levels. Or I can say it is the very first level where all three of them are present. Okay? It turns out that if you only have the planning graph I told you, the second two are the same. By the time the last guy comes in, everybody is already there waiting. Why? That is something that I did not make it obvious to you, but planning graph has a tenure system. Once you come in, you never go out. Right? Why is that true? If a goal, a literal comes into level I, then it's there at level I plus 1, I plus 2, I plus 3, etc. up to I plus infinity. Why? Because of the dummy action. Because every literal would be dummily persisted to the next level. So planning graph has a tenure system. Actually, really all you need to learn, I mean to represent the planning graph compactly in your computer is not this entire ugly structure, it is every literal and the first level at which it comes in. That's the only bit of information you need. Then you have the entire planning graph in front of you. And similarly, every action and the first level at which it comes in. So that would be a compact bi-level representation of this structure. That's how actually people use it. Okay, so because of that, the max heuristic, which takes, waits until the last guy comes in and then just takes that level, is the same as the level heuristic, which looks for the level at which all of them are present. For the case of positive interactions. Okay? So this is the last thing I'm going to do for you, which is I want to know which of these is better. So independent heuristic is also called sum heuristic, which means it's just summing the lengths of the plans for individual goals. Okay? The level heuristic is also called H level or H max, which is basically taking the longest plan I'm just taking that guy's value. My question is, which is better? And to answer that, of course, you have to ask, what do you mean which is better? Let's ask admissibility. Would H level be admissible? And would H sum be admissible? And to answer this, you have to answer my question like one of these guys here did, which is you have to think of a world where crazy things can happen. And such a world can be written as a planning domain, and then I get to yell at you saying, sorry, you know, you are inadmissible in that world. Right? Okay? So it turns out that if in fact the goals were positively interacting, and you summed up the levels, and summed up the length, then you would have overestimated the cost. Right? It's like Newton's cat and dog. That time you would be inadmissible. So you lose inadmissibility. And if you lose inadmissibility once in the whole wide world, then you're inadmissible. So it's a for all property. That means to disprove it, you just need one counterexample. In one domain, in one place, it happened. So you're dead. Okay? So H sum is inadmissible. H level, on the other hand, is clearly admissible. Because you will at least have to do as much work as the last guy. You know, if you have three goals and the third goal takes five steps at least, and you have to, and that's the longest time, then you have to at least wait for the last guy to come in. So it's clearly going to be admissible. Okay? But the problem with it is, in fact, if they were independent to begin with, or if they were negatively interacting, and especially if they're independent, then H level would be badly underestimating the heuristic. So instead of saying 20, which is 10 times 2, and there are 10 goals of length 2 plants each, it would just say 2. And that's the picture I made here. In this domain, I have essentially 100 goals, P1 to P100. Okay? And there are 100 actions, B1 to B100. Each of them give one of those goals. Okay? In this domain, on the other hand, there is an extra action, B star, which gives all 100 goals. If you apply H level here, it will say the length of the plan would be 1, because max of 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 is 1. So it will say the length of the plan for this domain is 1. That's a really bad estimate, right? Because the length is 100. If you apply H sum, it would be perfect in this case, because it will say 100 and 100 is the correct one. On the other hand, if you apply H level here, it will say the length of the plan is 1. Even if these actions are still present, they would only, one of the B1s would have put in P1, but the rest haven't yet come by the first level. They will only come after 99 more levels. And since this guy sneaks in everybody by the first level, all of them are already present in the first level. So H level will say level 1. I mean, 1 is the cost for solving all these 100 goals. And it's right. H sum, on the other hand, will say the cost of solving it is 100. And it is badly inadmissible. That means if you use H sum, you will get solutions that could be particularly off from the optimal solution. Is there a way out of this in the next 3 seconds? No, not level. A better idea is the following. Look at this graph. What do you want? P1, P2, etc., P100. For each of them, there should be somebody giving it. Right? So think of this as a graph. These are vertices, goals. For each goal, at least select one action from the previous level, which is giving it. And then whatever their preconditions are, do this recursively. If you do this, you would get what's called a relaxed plan. It's essentially a plan that would have worked if there were no negative interactions. You could have executed it. Okay? So you're using this planning graph structure and tracing a plan, which is a subgraph of this graph. Okay? And if you do that here, you would get actually all the 100 actions will be part of the subgraph, because each of them is supporting one of them. If you do this here, you will get this one only, because obviously, you know, the optimal one is B star. It supports everybody. Okay? So that's called H relaxed plan. And H-relax plan is better than both H-sum and H-level. The only problem, of course, is sometimes, you know, you can have a large enough graph, and for a particular goal, there may be multiple supporters. And which one do you pick? It turns out, since there are no negative interactions, whichever action you pick, you will be able to continue all the way to the end. You never have to backtrack. So greedy methods can be used. Okay? And in fact, relaxed plan heuristics use greedy methods to find the plan length. Okay? But if, suppose, God forbid, you wanted admissibility, then you need the optimal relaxed plan. That, as a nice parting gift, is still NP complete. Okay? So if you want optimal relaxed plan, I said in the beginning of the class that planning is P-space complete. It's worse than NP complete. So I'm now telling you that if you ignore all the negative interactions between actions, and all you're trying to find is the shortest plan, and people only help each other, they don't hurt each other, you don't really want to live in a world where people help each other also, it turns out, computationally speaking. You just want to live alone yourself, you know, and just leave me alone. Because if they try to help you, trying to find the optimal plan is NP-hard. Okay? And relaxed plan heuristics, actually, I will skip all over this, but relaxed plan heuristics are useful. Relaxed plan heuristics are actually being used by all the current state-of-the-art planners. And there was a particular slide I wanted to show you. I don't think I can. But the scale-up that you can get between, let me just show you that and you can go home, if I can. The scale-up you can get, okay, this one. Okay, so here's a little planning, a little picture about the state of the art in planning. Back in 95, which I think some of you were still born by then, okay, this was a state of the art planner which was solving planning problems in rocket world. And the rocket world essentially has, there are multiple rockets on the Earth, and they can only go one way to the moon, and you have a bunch of packages that need to be transferred to the moon, and you need to figure out how many rockets to send. Okay? And here are the number of packages, and here is the time taken to solve the planning problem. Very happy exponential curve. You know, when you got into search, that you are stuck with exponentials anyway, right? Okay, but this is really bad. Okay? Now, this is actually, you know, that's 95. This is actually 4 years back curve, where current planners right now use this kind of relaxed planning graph idea, relaxed plan idea, which is based on planning graphs. Okay? They don't do negative interactions, it turns out. And they can solve problems of much larger, plans of much longer length. Okay? Like hundreds of actions. If you have hundreds of actions, it's B power hundreds is the total complexity of search. And the fact that you can solve it, and I actually made available an executable for one of the planners called FF that you can play with on the web page that was sent to you. Did you guys get that mail from Huanlu? So the audio, as well as I put, being ambitious and optimistic guy that I am, I even put a homework problem that you can do, and just for being good, and you'll get a badge of being admissible. And then I also have a code for FF, which is a Linux executable. You can play with it, and you know, you can see how fast the plan can be generated. And that's a great way to feel really depressed about your old A-star search code that you did for the project one. Okay? And the piece that I want you to understand is that picture that I drew, which is the best heuristics can't be limited by your lack of imagination. Because you think the best ideas that you can think of are straight line heuristics, those aren't the ones that are the best. This is across the board, actually, in search literature. There is a great idea called pattern databases, which I don't know whether you guys have talked about. And those are heuristics that take terabytes of memory to save. But then they are the only ones that can solve 24 and 35 puzzle problems. And you might say there are better things to do in life than solving those puzzles, but, okay, it's a great idea, understanding about complexity of search and how the best heuristics come from. Thanks for listening to me, and next week, Huanlu will be back.